So let me just give you the title. You can't write it down. You might be interested in this. What does this then tell you? I think you know what the title will be and the sermon is going to be about.
Time to wake up.
As you're asleep. No, no, Daryl, you're not. Peter's denial. Peter's denial. The cock crew. But was it a cockerel? Was it a rooster? It didn't have to be. It doesn't make the story any different. But of course, we've always got that particular feeling that it was a rooster, and it may well have been. But there is an alternative understanding to that, interestingly enough. So this was a lectionary a few months ago, and I prepared for that, and I thought, well, it's something which I gave last week in Baddow, because we're slightly off, not off topic, but we're not exactly following a lectionary every single week. But every sermon gets better the second time it's given. And so I thought I'd give this one again that we gave in Essex last week. Not Great Baddow. The church has moved to Essex, about 45 of us in Essex, and that's Chelmsford down there. It's just a different part to where Great Baddow was. The same city anyway. So by way of introduction and about denial, let me give you a very soft example of denial of two people as an introduction. Because 18 years ago yesterday, I was in Bury St Edmunds, and there was a lady in the Norwich congregation who had retired, stone deaf, down to Bury St Edmunds care home, a very cultured lady called Doris Taylor Balls. I don't think anybody will remember that particular name. Penny and I remember her well. A lovely lady in the Norwich congregation. Husband Peter, who was a farmer, he wasn't in the church, but they didn't make any difference. And Doris eventually had to move from where she was living, not far from Bury St Edmunds, and went down to a care home in Bury. And so I made an arrangement to see her. So it was a rainy day, took my umbrella, drove the car down 15 miles south, because we lived just south of Norwich. And there was this balconade, you know, with glass frontage stretching along the care home. It was raining. And I didn't want to spend too long in the rain, so I put my umbrella out, parked the car. And there was this lady with white hair looking out expectantly, and I looked in expectantly, rushed in, and we gathered each other up in arms. Oh, how lovely to see you. How are you? And it was so good, you know, because it had been about 5 years since I had the opportunity to visit her in that particular care home. Anyway, we got chatting, of course, as you do, surface conversation, you know, ceremonial. How are you? Oh, what an awful day. So I'm shaking my umbrella. It's so nice. So how are you? Oh, very well indeed. How are you? Oh, pretty good, thanks, you know, getting older and wider and all those expressions you have, surface expressions. And how are the children? Oh, they're fine. You know, they're growing up bigger and taller all the time, as they do. How are yours? Oh, very good indeed, you know. And the conversation went on like this for about 5 minutes, I would think. We covered all the basics, you know, about the weather and how are you and the children and how are you keeping it? How's the care home? It was very good. I really enjoy the care home here. Yeah. I'm so pleased you're well looked after. But after about 5 minutes, the conversation, you know where this is going? The conversation started to tail off a little bit. It kind of, well, what do we say next? And eventually it ground to a halt. And she looked at me and I looked at her. And she said, I don't think we know each other, do we? And I said, I don't think we do. It wasn't Doris Taylor Balls at all. It was a lady in my mind, rather like Doris Taylor Balls, but I wouldn't tell Doris I'd met this other lady because she might make comparisons. And I went to see Doris eventually, but it was so nice to talk to a complete stranger under a misapprehension and denying that we knew each other at all. And so we had a hug and I went my way and she went her way. But it was very nice. You know, you meet people who are strangers and you've got no history one way or the other. You meet people in the street and bump into somebody and apologise and look at each other's eyes. And I like that. I love meeting people I don't know because in the end, you know, there's no history. There's nothing either way and you can start afresh. You might not even meet that person in this life again. But anyway, I could get into that story, but I'm not going to take that particular diversion. But there's an example, brethren, of a couple of people who didn't know each other and denied they'd ever met. And I'd never met her before. She'd never met me. She was waiting, actually, for her long-lost nephew from Australia. So she's expecting somebody to come. She hadn't seen him for a long time. And I pop up, and we both made that assumption that this is whom we're going to be talking to, the nephew. She didn't recognise me, and I thought I'd recognised her. Anyway, just a story. That was 18 years ago yesterday, according to my diary. So it's a denial compared to the far more serious denial we're going to have a look at this particular time. I suppose the question I would ask us all, myself included, what lessons can we learn from Peter's denial of Jesus Christ just before that crucifixion? And as he disowned Christ for that particular moment of weakness, can that help us in any particular way in our lives? Can it encourage us? It's not all negative. There's some good things to learn from this particular example that the lectionary drew our attention to. I don't know about you, but I've gone against my conscience and denied something or somebody in my life. I can think of examples. Saying one thing and doing another. It does happen, doesn't it? In your heart, you think, well, maybe I shouldn't have said that, or maybe that's not quite the right thing, but I can't get back and backtrack at the moment. And I suppose because of our feeling about this story in the Bible 2,000 years ago, we think of it in older terms, don't we? We think of older sepia pictures. We think of religious pictures with halos and people looking up at Christ who's floating off the ground. Try and take our minds back to the reality of that time. Clouds were glue. They're blue, white and a blue background. The cumulus are out. It's a lovely day. The Middle East with a high sun. It's the evening time, of course, when this particular denial took place, as you will know. It's full moon. There's light of the moon. And the reality of people in all their colours and everything else. And sometimes our thinking can get a little bit old-fashioned, and the only evidence we have are these pictures, which really don't seem to paint a picture of what we normally see in everyday life. I'm not getting against religious pictures and ideas, but the reality is, you know, the grass was green, the sky was blue, the clouds, and the moon out at night and all of those things. So let's put our thinking into that particular area and see how we go with it. And let's first consider this man, Peter, because that's whom we're talking about, as you know. Who was Peter? How was he? Let's remind ourselves of some of the things that the New Testament talk about Peter. The Old Testament doesn't record him, obviously, but apparently it's over 150 times in the New Testament. You'll have the word Peter or his derivatives from that name, Simon and so on, Simeon. He was a complicated individual. An imperfectly perfect life, you want to say that, for what turned out later, but he was a human like we are. Probably a man in his 30s, rather like Jesus Christ for age. His life went right through to about age 65, so he was martyred at the age of retirement, as we see retirement. So he had a long 30-year career or more after Jesus Christ's time. He was the first disciple. Andrew, his brother, introduced him to Jesus Christ. And then was James and John, as you know. You'll record Peter was the one of the three at the Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John. God doesn't play favorites, of course, but there is a time when he will use certain people ahead of time, like with Israel. He didn't call the Gentiles, he called Israel. Everybody today is not rushing into the kingdom of God through Christianity and baptism. So God works at certain times, but he's not taking favorites or anything like that. But there are certain times when he works with certain people, and Peter, James, and John particularly were the inner three for that purpose at that time, as you know, and Peter was certainly the stronger of the three. Transfiguration, walked on water, self-appointed spokesman for the disciples, a travelled man. In the New Testament also, he was resurrecting Tabitha to life again in Acts 9:36. He gave the first powerful Pentecost sermon, as you know, when he was very strong in what he said. And his name means hearer, apparently, the word Simon, Peter. Simon means hearer. He was from Bethsaida. His dad was called Jonah. We don't know his mum's name. He was married, there's no doubt about that. He lived in Capernaum, not very far, of course, from the Sea of Galilee, because he was a fisherman. Loud and confident man. leader of men, tough guy, peak physical condition. Apparently when you're in the 30s, it's on the way down after that. On the way down when you get into your 40s, 50s and even further. But he was a tough guy, crude, swearing fisherman. They were that way particularly. Remember with Malchus, he got a sword out when he was defending Jesus Christ, was about to, I'm sure, cut Malchus's head off, but missed and snipped his ear off. And of course that was healed by Jesus Christ. I always wonder why Christ must have known he had a sword. You know, he wasn't using somebody else's sword. He was in his scabbard. He put that sword back in its sheath, Christ said. But he was carrying a sword anyway, because he obviously was expecting, as an unconverted person, because we're not talking about conversion, we're talking about carnal humanity here with Peter until Pentecost. And he wrote the two epistles, which of course show a totally different strain of individuals, the two epistles of Peter. He was the one who, remember, the sheep was brought down from heaven in Acts, and God was saying, well, now just let me teach you a lesson about the animals on the sheet. And of course he was, as versed in the Old Testament, saying, no, I'd never eat anything like that. That was Peter and that particular one. First man into the tomb. He and John ran. John ran ahead of him, but stopped at the tomb entrance, and Peter rushed straight in. That's Peter, in for a penny, in for a pound, and was, of course, amazed when he saw what was going on. And in 1 Corinthians 15, the resurrection chapter, it talks about first Peter and then all the rest of the disciples. So Peter's name is paramount in that. He was the most sternly corrected by Jesus Christ of all the disciples. And millions of people from that time to this know his problems, know his denial. And of course, when he's resurrected, when you and I are resurrected, he's going to know that millions knew what he did. And it's not going to make the slightest difference, because he was used for great examples for people's lives. And I'm sure my own particular feeling, I'm not talking about what scriptures tell us, but in the resurrection, I'm sure we'll have the opportunity to meet these people. And to meet Peter, wouldn't that be nice, in a different space-time continuum where things are different, and we'll have the opportunity of meeting some of these great luminaries and seeing a rerun of history, however God has recorded that. That's just my own particular feeling on that. Peter had the say when Judas was replaced by Matthias. I have a note that he was not the first pope. Peter was not the first pope, despite what others may say. And Paul was also correcting him a little later on when he ate with the Gentiles in Galatians 2. You might remember he was kind of running with a hare and hunting with the hounds about that. But Mark's gospel, I understand, was probably Peter's gospel. And it was penned by Mark. Mark wasn't a disciple. He wasn't a follower of Jesus Christ at that time. But he was one who penned what we know as Mark's gospel. And Peter was the background of all of that. And of course, he's able to talk about his denial in very open terms. Now, I suppose if we had to choose which of Jesus' disciples to identify with, I don't know who it would be, but I think it would be, for me, Peter. Simeon, Cephas, Petros, all these other names for the same person. But he does reflect very often the way of human nature and the way that things are and the way that we are in our rawest sense. Every time he stumbled in a doorway or spoke about it, someone was around to receive it. You know, he was very outspoken, a bit like a celebrity today. Can't do anything unless the papers get hold of it. And his skin, people said, seemed to be as thick as his skull. And when his mouth outran his brain, as it often did, he spoke something everyone else was afraid to say. So he opened his mouth, put his whole leg in sometimes. But he's the disciple of the people, and we know he sinned badly, and he's a good representation of all of humanity. So a little thumbnail sketch of some of the highlights in Peter's life before we continue. He was bold in preaching, of course, and missionary work, and the difference on Pentecost, Simon says, July the 5th, when Pentecost comes through, He was certainly someone who said, Jesus of Nazareth, Acts 2:22, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs, is Peter on the day of Pentecost, that God did through him in your midst. As you yourselves know, this Jesus delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. You know, tough, open, converted, but strong in what he said. Kind of in-your-face individual, wasn't he? You'll be aware of not C.S. Lewis, you'll be aware of him, but C.H.S., Charles Haddon Spurgeon. Spurgeon was a great Baptist preacher, and he makes a few points here which I will read concerning this particular passage in Luke 22, or John 18. And the passage we're looking at about the denial, as you'll know, is the Lord turned and looked upon Peter, and Peter remembered the word of the Lord, how he said to him, before the cock crow, you will deny me thrice, and Peter went out and wept bitterly. And Spurgeon, in one of his sermons recorded from the 19th century down at the Metropolitan Tabernacle, the Baptist Tabernacle in Elephant Castle, South London, Peter's fall, says Spurgeon, as we noticed in our reading, is four times recorded at considerable length, but it is not once excused. There is not in any one of the records a single word said by way of palliation of his great guilt. This is a sermon that Spurgeon preached to 6,000 people without a microphone. John pictures Peter's sin in colours of almost neutral tint, yet he doesn't lessen its gravity. Why, think you, is this sad record thus given four times? Is it not in order that we should give it fourfold attention? It deserves a special mention first because it must have greatly increased the grief of the Lord Jesus Christ to know that while he was enduring untold indignities on his people's behalf, his most prominent disciple was denying him with oaths and curses down at the lower end of the hall. So, you know, after the Garden of Eden, after the Last Supper, they went across Kidron to the garden there. And they were sleeping when Christ was praying to his Father, this cup be removed from me, you remember that well. And then they went across to the area, and Jesus was captured, in that sense, not captured, but gave himself openly to the band that came along, and then was hauled into Caiaphas, the high priest, and so on. And oaths and curses from Peter at the lower end of the hall. So Peter and the other disciples fled, but Peter went back into where Jesus had been taken bound and was just hanging about in that hall. The others had gone. But at least Peter was taking the time to go into the lower end of the hall where he could see Christ through the open window of the hall. He was by that brazier, remember, a fire, and warming himself, and Jesus was up in the upper room, being inquired as to whom he was. Surely this denial must have cut Christ to the quick. I cannot imagine, says Spurgeon, that any of the tortures that he endured from his enemies could have caused him so much pain as this wicked denial by one of his closest friends. Let your pity and love to Jesus flow in deep and broad streams while you behold him that ate bread with him, thus lifting up his heel against him, and even declaring that he knows not the man. I know not the man. He didn't say Jesus. He wouldn't even use that word. So his human nature at this particular time was rampant. And even declaring that he didn't know him, blessed master, there is not one tint of all the colours of grief, says Spurgeon, that is lacking in the picture of your passion. It is not possible to depict sufferings more acute and intense than were yours when you did die, the just for the unjust to bring us to God. I think that Peter's fall and restoration are thus fully recorded in all four Gospels to set forth the greatness of our Redeemer's saving power in immediate prospect of his cruel death upon the cross. Is it not wonderful to think that before he dies, he restores this great backslider? I had almost said this open apostate, for so he was, according to his own language, though he was not so in heart. I can say, in imagination, see poor Peter bending before the cross of Calvary and looking up through tears of grief and joy as he mourns his great guilt and sees it all forgiven. Then comes the dying thief to represent another class of the characters who bring great glory to our dying Lord. Peter is the backslider, restored. The dying thief is the sinner, saved at the 11th hour. Moreover, nearly there, do you not think that there is in this fourfold record an instinctive lesson for us concerning this fragility of the best of men and women? Holy Scripture does not tell us much even about the best of men who lived in the olden times. Its history of the saints is somewhat scanty, but it's particular in recording their faults, as if its special purpose was to remind us that the best of men are but men and women at their best. Thus, Peter, who seemed to lead the van, was so frail and fallible, so far from being the first infallible bishop of Rome, that he even denied his Lord and Master. That is about the only point, as far as I can see, in which the Pope of Rome is like Peter, for he too has great presumption, and he this goes on about the Catholic Church. So anyway, I could read on and on. If he writes very well, it sounds better, I'm sure. It sounded better in the time at which he gave it. But that's what Spurgeon said about this particular episode and how the frailty of Peter is signposted and highlighted for us all to see and to all realise within us we all have the same thing. From our human nature is still there, although, of course, God's Spirit witnesses with our spirit, of course, that we are now converted and we are brothers and sisters of Jesus Christ. Nevertheless, the old nature hasn't been taken away. In our worst of moments, we can say, you know, individually, I can understand how Peter got himself into this situation. John often records different details. John 18 is the area that I will particularly be looking at as we progress. And although John omits the Gethsemane story, when the disciples fell asleep, and I think that would have been Peter not having the strength he should have. He wasn't listening to the prayers and joining in the prayers of Jesus Christ. But he was tired, probably for good reason, and he probably felt he had enough strength in himself not to deny Jesus Christ. But although John omits the Gethsemane story, he probably alludes to it in 18:11, because you'll see there, shall I not drink the cup the Father has given me, John records, which would attest back to Gethsemane. But the particular record of Gethsemane in its fullness in Matthew, Mark and Luke is not in John. But before that garden prayer, Zechariah kicks in, because in 13:7 it does say, strike the shepherd and the sheep will be scattered. So Christ mentions that. And then Peter says the famous phrase, though they all fall away because of you, I will never fall back. Well, who they are, I don't know. Was he referring to his brothers and the other disciples? They might all fall away. I'm not going to. Here's loudmouth again with all his strengths and weaknesses. And of course, Christ said, as you well know, truly I tell you, this very night before the cock crows, you're going to deny me three times. And Peter said, you remember, even though I must die with you, I'm not going to deny you. And all the disciples said the same thing, you remember. And Jesus' words about not denying him would come to pass immediately after Judas betrayed Jesus Christ. And as I say, it was a time of terrible trial before the crucifixion, because Christ wouldn't sleep that night. He would be taken after the interrogation the next morning into the crucifixion. So Peter follows, waits in the courtyard, and three people approach him. The others are all fled, but Peter came back. Christ would know this would happen. Christ wasn't surprised by this, because he did say it. But Peter said, maybe Peter's strength wasn't there, because he did sleep, and he probably felt he had enough strength himself not to ever deny Jesus Christ. But he waits in the courtyard. Three people come up. John just mentions the two, no problem there, and asks if he knows Jesus. Normal question. And just as Christ had predicted, he denies knowing Jesus Christ, doesn't he? Even though he's identified as a Galilean by his speech. If I say, well, good gracious, I've been to this particular city, you probably know I came from Birmingham, which I don't. I'm a Yorkshireman. But our speech will betray us very often, unless we've taken elocution lessons. I would mumble my words out. So anyway, they come up and say, you know, you are, because I recognize your speech. Of course you're one of his. And he's recognized as a disciple by a relative of the high priest's servant, whose ear was cut off. That's interesting, because the ear was cut off, you remember, just as Judas came up, and Peter just jumped to the situation and took that sword out and slammed across to Malchus. And missed his head like a ripe cabbage and took his ear off. Now, I suppose Christ either
knelt down and picked up the ear and put it back on. It does say the right ear. The Bible's full of detail, isn't it? And healed it. So that's a story in itself as to how that happened. The Galilean speech, that rough speech, especially with the curse words, he probably used these curse words and swearing because that would prove to them he knew nothing about Jesus Christ at all. And he's just a fisherman. What are you talking about? I don't know that particular man. But the third time, Peter denies knowing Jesus Christ. And then that cock crowed, or that rooster, or whatever it was. And then Luke's gospel also says that at that time Jesus turns to look at Peter through an open window. So Peter's there warming himself by the fire. Then he gets up and moves to the corner, maybe into the shadows where he's not going to be asked any more questions. But then it says that Jesus Christ in the upper room of this area where Christ is being interrogated by the high priest turns and looks at Peter, having just denied Jesus Christ. And all the accounts describe how he weeps when he realizes what he's done. An immediate response, I don't even know the man, three times, and off it goes. And Peter realizes, oh, I'm not going to have too much of that, too. Now, interesting, another point, the Gospels give no reason for the betrayal. It just says that's what happened. And maybe the disciples are afraid they'll too get arrested and so on. But it does show that you don't need to be perfect to be a servant of Jesus Christ. We're not perfect, I'm not perfect, but we can still be, as Peter was, a servant of Jesus Christ. They just had the Passover, as you know, and the great words at the Last Supper. And then Judas went off and brought a band of people into that area. With the high priests and Pharisees coming with lanterns, torches and weapons. They came really armed up, didn't they, to capture Jesus Christ. You might think, what for a carpenter and three buddies? You think, what's this all about? Four people particularly. They're coming with lanterns, torches and weapons. And then Peter, as we've said, does the same thing as all the disciples do. He gets up and he flees away. And he faces the most embarrassing time in his ministry, that he's denied Jesus Christ, not once, but three times. And I think this is the Peter we know, the one we'd rather not identify with, although we know we do identify with him, because we have the same human nature. Things can happen in a different way to us as well. And then in John 18:4, just to read the account rather than me put words around it, Jesus, therefore, 18:4, New King James, knowing all things that should come upon him, so he wasn't surprised by this because there were great lessons to come out of it, even though he was human and it must have hurt him to the quick, both God and man, of course, as Christ was, the God-man, went forth and said to those, who are you going to seek? It was a kind of rhetorical question when these people came to gather Jesus Christ to the high priest. And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Christ said, I am he. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. And verse 6, as soon as he said that, I am he, this crowd went backwards and fell to the ground. So when Christ said, I am, and of course the great seven I ams in John, he's saying who he is. And normally, you know, we'd fall on our faces before Jesus Christ. But in this particular account, of course, people fall backwards, which is interesting because they are aware of what he says and they are kind of smitten in reverse. And again, he says, who do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. In verse 8, I have told you I am he. If you therefore seek me, let these others go their way, that the saying might be fulfilled, which he spoke of them, which you gave me, I have lost none. John 18:10, then Simon Peter, having a sword, drew it, smote the high priest's servant, cut off his right ear. Servant's name was Malchus. Then Jesus said to Peter in 11, put up your sword into its sheath, the cup which my Father has given me, shall I not drink it? Referring to Gethsemane through John. Then the band and the captains and officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him, led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. And verse 14, Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient that one man should die for the people. Of course, that's the story of Barabbas. And so it goes. So we know also in the account that Jesus had revealed to Peter that Satan had asked for permission to sift Peter like wheat. So Peter was an open a sitting target for the powers of the darkness of this world. Jesus could easily have protected Peter and not allowed Satan to sift him, but Jesus wanted to equip Peter to strengthen him, because the outcome of this, of course, is always positive. But it goes into this negative denial first, but it turns into something so strong, and Peter was such a tremendous disciple and leader of men. All part of a plan, but in line with free will. Jesus knew what was in mankind. You see, he knows what's in man and women. So he knew what was coming, but it still came through free choice. Then verse 15, Simon Peter, this is 18:15, John. Simon Peter followed Jesus, another disciple, a disciple was known to the high priest, went in with Jesus to the palace of the high priest. That's probably John. John 18:16, Peter stood at the door without, then went out the other disciple, which was known to the high priest, and spoke to her that kept the door, and brought in Peter. And then the disciple that kept the door to Peter and said, a very innocent question in 17, are you not also this man's disciple? He said, no, I'm not. And the servants and officers stood there who'd made the fire of coals, verse 17, for it was cold, that they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. So you can imagine the scene. Let your mind go into this room with a burning fire, with a high moon, probably clear sky, so a certain amount of light, but it wasn't daylight. The high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and doctrine, and Christ said, I spoke openly to the world, I even taught in the synagogues and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in secret I've said nothing in secret. Why are you asking me? Ask them that heard me. What I have said to you, to them, behold, they know what I said. And when he'd spoken that way, can you imagine? Struck across, oh, that hurt. Struck across the face. Well, somebody's got to be resurrected who said, I was the one who struck Jesus on the face. Verse 22, when he'd thus spoken, one of the officers who stood by it struck Jesus with the palm of his hand, saying, answer you the high priest so. I said, in innocence, this guy didn't know who Jesus was. But it's written for all to realize. And God's a great God who will not hold anything against people when they come to realize what was going on in this world. And it's a bit like the Golden Globes, isn't it, when Will Smith slapped the comedian across the face. It was rather a good slap, I thought. Did you see it on television? It struck me as rather he was striding straight up, and the guy at the other end didn't realize what was coming. Bang! He really caught him, a cracker. I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying it was all caught on camera. And, of course, Will Smith's lost his opportunity for the Golden Globes for a long time. Verse 23, Jesus answered him, if I've spoken evil, bear witness of this evil. But if why are you smiting me? And then back to Peter in 25, Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. And they said to him, are you not also of his disciples? Second time, he said, I am not. Verse 26, one of the servants of the high priest, being kinsman of whose ear Peter cut off, in other words, he knew this guy, Malchus, said, didn't I see you in the garden with him the third time? Peter said, denied again, and immediately the cock crew. The other gospel's saying the same thing. I don't think they add a great deal to that story, but Matthew 26, Jesus said to them, verily I say to you that this night, before the cock crow, you shall deny me thrice. And 26 again, Peter said to him, though I should die with you, yet will I not deny you. Likewise said all the disciples. And then in Matthew 26 again, then began he to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man. And immediately the cock crew. And again, Peter remembered the word of Jesus, which said unto him, before the cock crow, you shall deny me thrice. And he went out and wept bitterly. And Mark says much the same thing, which is probably Peter's account. Peter's here, according to Mark, who wrote it down. More likely, and Jesus said to him, truly I say to you, that this day, even in this night, before you the cock crow twice, you shall deny me thrice. But he spoke the more vehemently, should die with you, I will not deny you any wise. Likewise also said they all. So they're all very similar accounts of the same thing. So that's all the negative side of what happened that night. Let's go on to the outcome and just see how it all resolves itself as we move along here. So, do you love me? Here are three questions to three denials, aren't they? And John 21, you know, the breakfast conversation between him and Jesus. What was Christ going to say to him? Resurrection has taken place. There's no doubt Jesus Christ is manifest in the flesh. And Christ is on the shoreline of the Sea of Galilee, the Lake of Galilee. And don't ask me where Christ got the fish from, because the disciples had been fishless all night, as you know. But Christ had got breakfast ready, a bit of a barbie on the beach. And he got the fish and some honeycomb and so on, and they're going to have a meal. But the walk and talk with Jesus Christ and Peter didn't happen before the meal. They went through the meal first. I'm sure Peter's appetite had probably been wrecked by this, because he knew what was coming. At least he knew that it was going to be some sort of slap across the wrist, but it wasn't going to be that way at all, because Peter had put Jesus in the dock that night, and it was Jesus who had to go, not Peter. That's the way it was looking. But here's Christ resurrected. He made it through death. Peter saw the empty tomb with his own eyes. And it seems that Jesus Christ had something to say. What would it be? So here are the disciples. They've been fishing all night, nothing. They know about fish. And Peter's in his own boat. The rest of a few disciples are in another boat. And Christ says, "Hello, have you got any fish?" That's what whenever you're passing a canal or a lake and somebody's got a rod out, you're going to say, "Got any fish?" It's a normal question. And they say, "No." Very definite terms. Fishing all night, nothing. Zilch. Zero. And Christ said, "Okay, take the net and put it over." Was it the right side of the boat? And so they did, and nearly capsized the boat, because you've got 153 fish, wasn't it? And don't get spooky about the numbers. There are all sorts of ideas of why 153 that needn't appeal to us right now. But then Peter, knowing the master's voice on the shore, not far off, maybe 100 yards offshore, divested himself of garments that would halt his getting out of the boat and getting to shore. Got there first, because he knew it was his master. And Simon is now about to make this change to be rock-like Peter. It was interesting because the charcoal fire that Christ had, you know, braising this fish, would echo one Peter stood by only a few days before, saying, "I'm not a disciple of that man," because he warmed himself before a fire, didn't he? Here's Christ, he's got a fire. There are going to be three answers or questions to that. It could be an embarrassing meeting, you might think, if you put yourself in Peter's shoes, because all his mates are around him. And, of course, they're aware of what's happened in all of this. And Jesus asks those three questions, one for each denial. And I suppose after the meal, Christ said, "Peter, come on, let's go for a walk and a talk. Let's have a chat." And he calls Peter by his full name. And Christ knew the answer already, that Peter wouldn't deny him this time. But he wanted Peter to know it. And so Peter repeats it three times. It's a moment of healing. And he's having to face his falling and failing, while at the same time being invited to step free from the problems, like Christ does for us as well. And three times he denied Jesus Christ, as we said, and three times he's restored by Jesus Christ. He's humbled by that truth. And Christ never talks once about the three denials. He never slaps him across the wrist and says, "You naughty boy, I heard what you said." Christ's grace is sufficient for all. And he simply reaffirms Peter's calling to care for the churches, and asks him those three questions. Wants to make sure, "Do you love me?" "You know that I love you." And I was reading in the Greek, as you do, I don't speak Greek to even a word, but I noticed the word "knowest," "you knowest I do." It is E-I-D-O in the Greek, which is like, if you say it, "I do." Just a play on words, but, you know, "you knowest that I love you." And that word "know" is E-I-D-O, which I would take as being "I do." I sure do. I certainly do. So Peter then is strengthened. The rest you know, of course, with the Pentecost sermon, those 2, 3, 6, 7 weeks later, whatever it was. And there's a speculation that Peter and Paul were both martyred during the persecution of that early church. Tradition has it that Peter was martyred in his 60s, probably, and he didn't want to go the same way as Christ. He was crucified upside down, tradition has it. And as a married man, apparently also, when the Romans crucified him, they crucified his wife right in front of him. This is only tradition. So Peter's wife apparently went the same route. And he yelled to her, remember Christ, as his wife was crucified. So horrendous times. That is tradition, but it's more likely than not that all the disciples did meet, except John, who, as you know, was one of the eldest disciples before he died, would meet a martyr's death. And so where do we go with some of the thoughts about this? I suppose I could say here, having said all of that, and applying to us, that God's got great dreams for you and for me. Great dreams. We're free agents. We're converted. We have God's Spirit witnessing with our spirit that we are different, not because of anything but God's grace. And Christ saw very quickly what kind of man Peter could be. And the same way with us. He knows all your difficulties. You know, if your hearts condemn you, God's is greater than your heart. He knows all things. I think our hearts do condemn us at times because the channel to human nature works both through the human spirit and God's spirit, and sometimes the more human spirit that spouts out of our life and our mouth than the spirit of God. But God knows all these things, and you know, if our hearts condemn us, he's greater than our hearts. He knows those things. But you know, we would be strong to death. You remember Columbine, that terrible account of the massacre of 12 plus a teacher in 1999, Columbine High School in Colorado. When the gunman came in, a few people were asked, you know, are you a Christian? And one girl in her eight, not even 20, was a Christian. And she had been hammered by the shrapnel from a blast of the gun of one of the two pupils who was committing this massacre in 1999 in Columbine. She was hiding under a table, and he came up again. And she put her head up and said, he said, are you a Christian? She said, yes. Killed her. And so she looked him straight in the eye. Now, those stories get exaggerated and sometimes the wrong names are put. Doesn't matter. There were people there in their youth who are willing to stand up and be counted for Jesus Christ. Now, pray that won't happen to you and me. It's happened to many people, probably right now in parts of the world where you have to go underground to practice Christianity. Our brothers and sisters in Morocco, where Mr. Henderson visited, you know, there are converted people there, and they have to meet and wish to meet. But you could be killed for moving away from the Muslim faith in circumstances, away from the family into Christianity. If I was to be put up against the wall like this, and somebody was coming in, it has happened, of course, where people, in rare occasions, have taken a gun and come through the door. In America, in one of our derivative groups, apparently, who are meeting, a gunman came in and killed some of the people we might know by name in one of the derivative groups. But you imagine just standing here, and the guy comes up with a gun and says, are you a Christian? What would you say? What would I say? It's all very well now, isn't it, to say, yes, I am a Christian. What are you going to do about it? Have that gun put against your temple. Say that once more, or you're a dead man. I pray God that I would be strong enough to say, do it. The God I serve is greater than the God you serve. But that happens in one way or the other, one example or another around this world, probably even during this sermon. There are people who've had to lay their life down for what they believe. And in good times like this, even though the world's a desperate place right now, even in good times like this, you know, it's easy to say, I will continue through death, if necessary, to follow Jesus Christ. In our heart of hearts, not one of us here would say anything different. Yes, I'm going to die for Jesus Christ. In fact, you've already died, as you know. We're going to be baptizing somebody in Essex Church quite soon. And I'll be saying to him by the Baptist pool, where we take off the boards down in Brentwood, and put this particular individual into the water, I'll say, come and die. Because that's what we've done. You see, you've died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. Colossians 3:3. Lovely, you've died spiritually, and your life is hidden with Christ. Hidden with Christ in God, Colossians 3:3. So, you know, we have already died, but if we were faced to shorten our life in an instant by a gunman, in our minds we'd do it. If push comes to shove, we just pray we'd be given the strength that Peter didn't have because he was sleeping and he felt he had enough power of his own to not deny Jesus Christ. Pray that, you know, God is merciful and God is gracious, but that would never have to come to us, but we have those prayers and thoughts for our brothers and sisters around the world. Columbine certainly was a strong example of what actually did happen to a certain young girl. We know that Peter feared recognition as a follower of Jesus, thought he could blend in. Perhaps he thought the same thing in times. But he saw us struggling, notes say, he saw us in our sin. He sees us now and what we become in this life and the next. So God has great dreams for you and me, and they're being dreamt now, if I can put it that way. Secondly, God accepted Peter just the way he was. He accepts us just as the way we are. That's how we come. We don't bring trophies and say, because of this, you have to do that. We know that. We don't have to change to get God's attention. But once he has our attention, he starts to change us. And it's often through the mistakes we make, as with Peter. He is a template for a lot of, certainly the thinking that I can recognize in my life as I get older. He learned from his mistakes and embarrassing moments. Jesus wants to make us new, to transform us, but he also loves who you and I are. He makes you who you are, and those traits and trademarks are his doing. And Peter was still Simon the fisherman, even when he took leadership of thousands of people. So we make great mistakes, but at least we can do something in our lives by giving them to Jesus Christ. And thirdly, some headlines that I think are helpful to pass on. His great example to us is that he kept going. He didn't give up. Something's happened in public life, and I won't name names, but you think, how can that person, be a woman or a man, how can they ever show their face in public again, you know, all the things that have happened, because of the way the world is? And they often do keep going. They often do keep going. I mean, that MP who was caught looking at tractors on his iPhone, you know, I admire that man because he said, it's me, I did it, I'm sorry. You know, that's a strong thing. He didn't sort of, well, I just pushed the wrong button. I didn't. It's all a mistake. I wouldn't have it. No, he didn't. He said he was interviewed in his farm down at Tiverton in Dorset, and he said, yeah, it's me. I'm sorry. It was the most dreadful mistake I've ever made. I'm so sorry for my wife, and I own up to it, and I'm going to stand down. That's honourable. That's honourable. It doesn't take away from all of that. We're all in that situation, but that man went up in my estimation because of his response. Now, I don't say it was a perfect response, but, you know, would we be like that, or we try to obfuscate, lovely word, obfuscate, or cover up, or say, well, actually, you don't know all the story. Well, people do know the story, and they like a straight answer, perhaps, rather than one that's curved around. But God accepted Peter just the way he was. And he kept going, did Peter. So he taught us to get up, dust ourselves off, and move on. That is a great lesson through the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune. Another point, as we can conclude, you can see the clock. I can't, but I can now. It was based on weakness and fear. He was not equipped spiritually by listening to what Jesus Christ had said, and he denied that he would deny Christ, and Christ had prophesied he would deny him. But he was restored, and he urged Christians to be alert. You can read the two epistles and see a totally changed man, of course, as you do. And his weakness wasn't only in not praying, he was also fearful. So there are many, many lessons we can learn and identify with that, because we're all cut from the same cloth. And it takes a man like Peter, who is most outspoken, foul-mouthed in his human life, fisherman, you know, just a young man in his 30s who'd take no nonsense from anybody, a rough type. That's the sort of person God will use. Take and, like Paul, you know, just take and whittle down to size and use in the most powerful way. And so we do have that great concern for how God works with us. So God is the God of second chances, 70 times 7, my notes say. So in conclusion, lovely word, in conclusion. Remember John Newton, who was a hymn writer, Amazing Grace and so on? Apparently these words are on John Newton's grave, a slave trader. And there's a whole lot of stuff going on about slaves now, isn't there? And Bristol having statues torn down and universities eschewing all sorts of material about that. But on his grave is, here lies a dreadful sinner saved by a wonderful God. John Newton knew where he'd been wrong in his life, but he recognized also that he was saved by a wondrous God. And I can say, just like Elijah we looked at a month ago, you know, Elijah said with the prophets of Baal, when he was thinking he was the only one in a cave hiding from Jezebel, he said, I'm no better than my fathers. And humanly we're not. We're no better than our fathers. And God knows that and works with that. And we thank God so much for the past. because God has taken our life and will use it powerfully in our own particular way for other people's sakes, not just for us, because we have that responsibility of being servants to the whole human race. I always think that's amazing. What we've been through in conversion, as with other Christians in different denominations, is a template for the whole of humanity, who one day, not just the present population, but the billions, maybe 10, 20, 40, 100 billion, who knows how many people have lived and died on this planet under the heel of darkness of this world, that they will all, men, women, children, boys, girls, have to go through the same experience that we have been through in our first life. Most, as you know, will go through in their second life and in the resurrection when Satan isn't around, when society is very different, when self has been tamed. They will realize that they're going to need to, like we did, point ourselves to Jesus Christ. No other name under heaven whereby mankind can be saved. And one of the great strengths of our fellowship given us by God is the fact this isn't the only day God's working with people. Isn't that a wonderful truth? You know, he wants many sons and daughters to come to glory. He's not willing any should perish, but all should come to glory. And so we have that and come to repentance. And so everybody's going to have this opportunity, but not in this life, probably. You know, God doesn't play favorites, but he works with certain people at certain times. Worked with Israel, wasn't working with the Gentiles unless they came in as what do you call people who come in off the entire world? And not proselytes, but anyway, they come in as invitees to the nation of Israel. And some of the Gentiles did come in. But God worked with Israel, and then later on with the Gentiles. And the same with this world. One day, your example, as God uses you by his grace, will be used for billions of people who have to go the same route through baptism and conversion and realizing where we went wrong, having our eyes opened. That's an amazing thing. It's not just for us. It's for so many. And, you know, percentage-wise, there aren't many Christians in this world compared to the massive population who've come and gone for no fault of their own, not knowing anything, whether they be the pygmies in the Ituri forest or whether they're people in other religions, you know, we could name and mention who are not Christian based. There's no other name. And thank God we know that the grace of God will reach the unevangelized dead. Isn't that a wonderful phrase? The grace of God will reach the unevangelized dead, and that you'll be there to love them, to comfort them, to help them, and to shepherd them. Because this is our tremendous privilege as servants of Jesus Christ. We're there for other people, not just for this planet, but one day we can think about the universe and how we're going to restore and build all things as God wishes. So 1 John 3:18 in conclusion. 1 John chapter 3, verse 18. My little children, let's not love in word, neither in tongue, but in deed and in truth. And hereby we know that we are of the truth and shall assure our hearts before him. For if our heart condemn us, God is greater than our heart. He knows all things. Beloved, if our heart condemn us not, then have we confidence towards God. And whatever we ask, we receive of him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. And this is his commandment, that we should believe on the name of his Son, Jesus Christ, and love one another as he gave his commandment. And we have learned today, and have more importantly learned, not just to obey God, but to love God as well. And I shall conclude with the sound of the cockerel in that sense. Was it really a cockerel? The Greek can also mean one of the watches of the Roman evening. You know, 9 to 12, 12 to 3, 3 o'clock when the ashes were taken off the altar. Because there's a question whether a cockerel would be allowed in the city of Jerusalem. Certainly the Jews wouldn't have had a cockerel there around the temple. So it's moot, but it doesn't make any difference to the great story. It could well have been the fact of the changing of the guard at 3 a.m, because the Greek words are very similar to rooster as to the changing of the guard. But either way, it doesn't matter. There's more behind the story than that. And it taught me a great deal about my own particular life and how I can look to Jesus Christ and learn that, 70 times 7, you know, Jesus Christ is all we need. In fact, Jesus Christ is all that we've got. So let's sing about that, if we're going to be ready for it, and then we look forward to having some time together. And next time I'll play you a little bit of special music.